Well, I just have a little clarification. I'm actually chair of the department now, and I need to take credit for that because I don't know if my career will survive being chair. It's really hard to get any work done with all the meetings that I have to go to. So, but anyhow, this is a somewhat of an odd talk because of this combination of purposes here in terms of presenting some of my work, but also some ideas about how you get work funded, particularly work that is, as most of my work is, somewhat untraditional. And I have to say, this is not intervention research. This is actually descriptive research. It could be used to generate project ideas for intervention research, but it is not itself intervention research. And I want to acknowledge my colleague, Dr. Patricia McDaniel, who is project director for this study and really co-PI on the study. We don't have any relationships with commercial interests to disclose, although I do own a share each in Philip Morris and R.J. Reynolds tobacco companies for research and advocacy purposes, but I guess that doesn't rise to the level of disclosure. I wanted to just acknowledge also my research group and just to say a little bit about them, and I notice one of them is here. Hi, Naftali. I'm very blessed to have a very multidisciplinary research team. It includes historians, a naturopathic physician, sociologists, a political scientist, and nursing graduate students, and a whole range of people that are all working together on a set of projects that we've had going for quite a while. And so since part of this process is about ideas for getting your work funded, I thought I'd throw some out here in the beginning. Then I'm going to talk about this particular research project and some ways in which I think some lessons that could be drawn from it. But then hopefully leave a lot of time for questions. So, you know, to my mind, one of the keys in terms of getting research funded, period, is to keep up with policy changes. And one of the ways you do that, obviously, is by watching the media for trends and thinking about what you're seeing that seems to be somewhat unusual or seems to be new. And how does that shape what is going to be happening out front, out in the future, in terms of public health, both public health practice and policy? Find new ways to approach public health topics. And here, I would just encourage you to sort of break out of traditional ideas about what nursing is and think much more broadly, which most public health nurses are already inclined to do, but just not to constrain yourselves. And in addition to that, looking at theoretical framing beyond nursing theory. Because although some nursing theory is great for public health research projects, you may have a wider audience appeal for reviewers if you are looking at theories beyond nursing. Apply to other institutes. If you're applying for NIH funding, don't consider yourself restricted to the National Institute of Nursing Research. It is one of the smaller institutes, and of course they have to set priorities because of their limited budget. Many of the other institutes, I've been funded for quite a long time now through the National Cancer Institute, and they have a much larger budget. So they do fund public health related research, as do some of the other major institutes that have more money. Make it sexy. Think about different ways to package the study, and that's a hard thing to really be explicit about explaining, but it's just somehow setting up your proposal in such a way that reviewers are led to be screaming for this to be done by the time they finish reading it. You really have to work on your logic structure so that it leads you straight to a point where the reviewers say, oh, this study is really needed. Oh, they're really onto something here. Oh, this is something new. Or we really need this knowledge. work with colleagues from multiple disciplines, and I think this is a very helpful thing to do because colleagues from other disciplines outside nursing bring new perspectives and new ideas and help you notice things that you might not otherwise notice. We have some of our most fertile ideas have come out of our research team meetings where we're just discussing things. And somebody says, wow, here's something that I just saw, and isn't that interesting? And then further discussion happens. And develop pilot data. And what I'm going to present to you are pilot data from a study that we did that then we went on to get NIH money for. And finally, as my mentor taught me when I was a graduate student, if at first you don't succeed, rework and apply again. And if you still don't get it, then apply someplace else. But really take to heart all reviewer comments and think about how you can make your proposal better. And every single funded researcher has been turned down multiple times, just like every single published author has been turned down multiple times. So get over it. Just to get to this study, I think public health nurses are certainly familiar with the problem of tobacco and the fact that it's the largest preventable cause of death in this country and getting to be that way worldwide. In California, there are more than 40,000 outlets that sell tobacco. That's a problem. It's a public health problem because outlet density increases the likelihood of smoking, and the advertising associated with retail outlets promotes use and cues smoking urges. And of course, we can't ban advertising in this country like they do in many civilized countries because advertising is viewed as freedom of speech. The ubiquity of seeing retailers on every corner, of having cigarettes available everywhere, normalizes the sale of this. And so you always are faced with the problem of people saying, if it's that bad, why do they sell it on every street corner? So limiting the number of retailers advances tobacco control efforts, and it does so, whether that's done through policy changes and mandatory ordinances, or whether that's done through voluntary initiatives. And the idea came to us in one of our group meetings, where we had begun to notice that some retailers were voluntarily abandoning tobacco sales. We read some media accounts of this happening both in California and elsewhere. New York was one of the places, New York State. And that's a very interesting phenomenon in a capitalist culture for anything that you can sell and make money on. To stop selling it, that is really an interesting thing. We looked into it and we realized nobody had ever looked at this before. So that's like gold anytime you think of something that nobody has actually looked at. And we had this discussion and this ferment of ideas and proposed this research project. So the study questions, we were going to look at retailers that had voluntarily ended tobacco sales. We applied for funding from our state tobacco research program here in California, TRDRP, to look at what motivated these retailers to do this. Why were they doing this? What did their employees and customers think about the decision? And was this covered in the media at all or advertised by the stores? So we proposed doing case studies of seven California retailers that we identified through media accounts as having abandoned tobacco sales. Our sample ended up including three grocery stores and four pharmacies. We conducted interviews with the owners, managers, and employees of these stores. We also conducted focus groups with customers of the stores to find out what they thought about this change in policy. And we did observations around the stores to see what was there, was there signage, were there other tobacco retailers around, and looked to see if there had been, what the total media coverage had been. So the stores were, the grocery stores were in affluent areas, and they tended to be stores that were somewhat high-end and focused on health and organic food, that kind of thing. They were sort of local chains with 2 to 9 stores each. And they really emphasized the organic, healthy, aspect. So these were somewhat unusual stores in that respect. The pharmacies were two independent pharmacies located in isolated areas, really kind of rural towns, and one independent and one chain in fairly affluent areas. The chain pharmacy also sold alcohol. So why did they end tobacco sales? Well, the independent pharmacies all said it was because of the link between tobacco and disease. That was their sole reason given for ending sales. And pharmacies have been working on this for quite a long time. In California, almost all independent pharmacies now do not sell tobacco, and it's the chains that still do it. In San Francisco, we now have an ordinance that does not allow even the chains to sell tobacco. So we have made progress in San Francisco. And of course, San Francisco was sued by the tobacco companies as a result of that policy, but the city prevailed. So as the owner of one pharmacy said, I've always had that idea to stop selling cigarettes. My grandmother smoked. She died of pulmonary embolism that I think probably had a lot to do with smoking. And my mom, a smoker, died of cancer. This is something that turned up quite a lot in our data, too, was that these owners and employees and even customers made reference to people they knew who had died from tobacco. So they were drawing these links already. We're trying to be so healthy. That's what a pharmacy is about. When I started selling in cigarettes as a clerk in 1960, we didn't know. So this is how I explained it to my staff. Was that at one time we didn't realize we shouldn't be selling cigarettes, but now it's more than obvious. Again, a pharmacy owner. So this is really consistent with their self-image of themselves as a health-promoting institution. As far as the grocery stores, they also mentioned health, but they also talked about regulatory pressures. Normally with cigarettes, you're going to have a younger crowd try to buy those. It's one less headache. It was that consideration and the fact that it's not a good healthy habit for people to have. So I figure, okay, I'm not promoting it if I don't sell the product. And so here you have sort of this confluence of the policy pressures of sting operations, for example, that grocery stores may feel, why do we want to take the chance that we may sell to a minor and get caught and it'll be a hassle? Another grocery owner said, over all the years when people complained from special interest groups to me, why do you sell this kind of meat and why do you sell this kind of fish? My stock answer used to be, if I'm going to decide what consumers should buy and they shouldn't buy at our store, I would start with cigarettes. My father died from emphysema. Again, noticing the personal connection. And in talking with my partner, we said, yeah, you know what? It's our store and it's our business. If we don't want to sell them, we don't have to sell them. Now, some of the stores did publicize their new policy. Two of the grocery stores alerted the media, one with a full-page ad and had a front-page newspaper article. A press conference was held that generated 2 news articles. And some of these stores worked with local tobacco control coalitions to try to alert people to what they did. Another owner, however, expressed a slightly different position. I don't like advertising the fact that we don't have a product. We compete quite a bit with a large supermarket chain. So if I put it in people's face, like we don't sell cigarettes, and they're buying their cigarettes with the shopping at the chain, it gives us a disadvantage. However, even with people like this owner, there was a strong belief that they did not want to go back to selling cigarettes. Some of the owners perceived that there had been a brief loss of customers after they instituted their policy of stopping tobacco sales. This owner said, I think I've gained customers now. It took a while. Initially, I think there was a downturn, but over time, the word got out. And I think it really was an advantage because people appreciated that I made that stand. So it was a good decision. The remainder reported no loss of customers and few complaints, saying it didn't affect business at all, nobody's gotten upset, everything is just fine. So this was instituted really with very little fuss at all. And in fact, they perceived that among smokers, there was some gratitude that it actually made it harder for them to buy cigarettes if they were trying to quit or they were trying to smoke less. It was one less place where it was in their face. Two customers, according to the owners, actually reported quitting and linked it to this new policy of not having them for sale. Among non-smokers, according to the owners, there was no or a positive reaction. There was a little bit of response from non-smokers. We think it's great, a bold move. So it was very well received from the point of view of the owners and managers. Among employees, most employees reportedly liked the new policy, and we did interview the employees separately from the managers. They said it made their jobs easier. They felt it was good for their customers' health. It was good for the image of the store. And I think this is very interesting in terms of the denormalization of smoking and how what smoking means has changed over the last few decades, so that this is actually seen as good for a store's image to not sell tobacco. The pharmacy employees particularly appreciated the consistent health message that not selling tobacco shaped. It was very embarrassing selling cigarettes here at the pharmacy. We're here to help people get better. And you get to know people, and you love the people that come in. It was very difficult for me to do that, especially when they had asthma, looking at them coughing and not being able to breathe and taking inhalers, and then later on looking at them outside smoking. Why did I just sell them cigarettes? That's absolutely not right. So when that stopped, it was like a relief for me. And customers did ask us, well, why did you stop? And it was very easy to answer them. Because we love you and we want you to get better and we're not going to sell you any more cigarettes. That's why we stopped. So it was shaped in this very positive, customer positive way. Managers were overwhelmingly quite satisfied with the owner's decisions to stop selling cigarettes. One said, I'd rather not sell them just to make a dollar. The money is not worth somebody's health, so I feel more comfortable. Another said, again, referencing a personal experience, it was great. I watched my grandfather die a slow death from smoking Camel Straight since he was 14. So the policy was very well received. Now, again, this is a very small study, only 7 stores, but it's remarkable the consistency with which people were supportive of this policy. The owners all were satisfied, even those that had some ambivalence were committed to maintaining it. As this one grocery owner was still somewhat uncomfortable in deciding for customers, saying, I'm not their priest, I'm not their teacher, I'm selling them groceries. But even he was not inclined to go back. Among customers then, how did customers feel about this change? Well, most of them didn't even notice. They weren't even aware of this policy, but when made aware of it, they were almost all supportive. A non-smoker said, it's a great idea. It's making a statement to the community that they're health conscious. Maybe they'll make a precedent for other people to follow. Among a smoker said, I know I might be contradicting myself. I am a smoker, but I also recognize that it's a healthy thing and there's plenty of other places if people want to get them. But teenagers and new smokers find it easily accessible, and the main issue is the kids, so I know it's contradicting, but I agree with that. I think it's a good decision. So even among smokers, again, positive response. Most said that it had minimal impact on their shopping behavior. A small number said they might even shop there more as a result because it made them feel more positive about the retailer. Made me want to shop there more. I lost a brother to stage 4 lung cancer in the last 2 years because he smoked for 35 years. I support and like their choice not to sell cigarettes. So again, I think tapping into people's awareness and making sure that people are aware that all these deaths that they have experienced in their own life are due to tobacco helps begin to change this. I think it's excellent. I mean, I commend them for that, and other stores should follow. It makes you want to go there more. You're like, they're taking the right stand. All right, I'll support them even more. Now, in terms of advertising the policy, customers felt that not advertising was really a waste of good PR. They felt that it should be known. Why do it if you're not going to tell everybody? Presumably you're doing it to build your name. They thought it actually could bring in more customers. The word would spread and people would like it because, and this is an important factor for us all to remember, the majority of people don't smoke to begin with. So really this is a response to that. They also saw the advertising as a way to stimulate change. They felt that it would help people realize the decision had to do with health, and it was really the retailer showing that and putting out that information about why. Another said a parent could say, look, they're not selling it. You know why? It's kind of an instrument to say, hey, you know, this is why they're not doing it. So it was education, health education provided in the retail setting to have this policy advertised. So overall, we found that in this pilot study, tobacco was really seen by the pharmacies and these healthy grocery stores as incompatible with their image. That's a new and interesting finding in tobacco control, that tobacco has now some sort of a negative association. And that's you know, considering how long it's been available in these stores and how glamorized it's been for how long, this is an interesting new finding. So advocacy efforts could emphasize the fact that doing this can make employees' jobs easier, that stores can get free positive publicity by working with public health organizations around this, that it might even increase patronage among supportive customers, and that it is can be a progressive policy in that stores could begin, say, by putting the product out of sight or by keeping it behind a locked cupboard and then move to saying, now we've decided to eliminate it, so that you don't have to leap immediately to elimination of sales, but you can signal your move in that direction to your customers and see how they respond. So in terms of back to the sort of research implications here, as I said, we used the findings from this smaller project to apply to NIH, to the National Cancer Institute, for a larger grant to do national sampling and prepare case studies of retailers that had done this, and we're now in the middle of working on that four-year project. For that project, we used diffusion of innovations as the conceptual matrix that helped us look at where we might look and the kinds of questions we would want to ask. We extended the project to include case studies of different types of businesses and policies. So we're now also looking at restaurants in states and cities where they're not required to be smoke-free that went smoke-free voluntarily. We're also looking at businesses that have a policy against hiring smokers, which is very controversial, and I'm not sure that that is a policy that's really effective for tobacco control, since it sort of demonizes smokers. But again, it's a voluntary initiative that businesses have undertaken for some business-related reason, and because they aren't just doing all this out of the goodness of their hearts. They want to make money. They want to be successful business people. So it's very interesting when they do something voluntarily like this that does have implications for public health policy. So I think just to summarize, and then maybe we'll have time for some questions or discussion, I want to just reemphasize, you might hear this study and you would think, what does that have to do with nursing? And I think my view of nursing has always been extremely broad. Nursing started out of public health traditions, as you guys all know, and working in the community and working with institutions. So we should not let our identity as researchers be constrained by traditional views of what nursing is. And tap into that tradition of working with community institutions to promote social change. I think nurses clearly can and should be engaging with communities and community retailers around health issues, and this doesn't just apply to tobacco, obviously. You know, we're concerned now with marketing of food and soda and that sort of thing. So there are many other aspects of this that I think, and of course there's always the accusation that you're going to head down the famous slippery slope. But this is really about public health and about having retailers that are providing things the community really needs. And I think the other thing is to just try to cultivate the skill of nimbleness to spot these emerging trends or things that are unusual or anomalies, places where there are these intersections happening between social change, health, and public health policy and practice. Those are very interesting junctions at which to target your research. I think that's it. Thank you.
Grocery store owners indicate how much money cigarettes they were selling, how much income they might have lost.
That's a good question. We didn't ask them specifically how much income they might have foregone, but we did hear from at least one retailer that he had begun to notice that cigarettes sales had dropped. And so this tells us this may be the kind of low-hanging fruit where you're looking at particularly places that are located in areas where smoking prevalence is already going down, to the degree that you can encourage those stores to begin to do this, then you may be able to work towards this diffusion process so that other retailers that are trying to be competitive will look at that. But we don't have the figures on that. It's a very good question. It would be a great study to do if, you know, we could get people to actually give us that data, which they're a little leery. You know, we had a bit of a time at first getting them to talk with us because, you know, they're business people. They're not used to being researched. But, you know, we kind of got into this, what does it take to get you into a new car today mentality when we would make our calls and became much more successful. But it's a really good question. And the other thing is that, you know, this definitely has clear social justice implications in terms of the fact that the ones that are doing it are in areas where there are more affluent populations, more probably better educated populations who already are smoking at lower rates. So they're just not raking it in as they are in lower income communities where smoking rates are higher. And that's a problem. But again, to the degree that you have diffusion out through social networks and that there is this sort of aspirational aspect to business where they would like to aspire to be bigger and better and more like, wealthier businesses, there may be some potential here to even work some of those angles. In the back?
I've not in the academic world, so I have a question about that. Is it, either we're in the practice world, so is it common that nursing schools have these research teams so that the practice community observed a trend and wanted some thoughts about it to help us in the practice environment? Is that common enough that you go to that research team and talk to them about figuring something out?
Well, I don't know if it's common everywhere. I mean, it's sort of the model that I was socialized to, was that you try to put a team together. And increasingly, academics are being encouraged to work across disciplines and to put teams together, because it just makes for more interesting questions and views on the work. And we're always thrilled when we hear from the practice community and they say, you know, we can't always do something right then, depending on how overloaded we are. But we're very thrilled. I mean, I think that's a feedback loop that we should do more to encourage, because the practice community often is the early warning system for stuff that we haven't seen yet. New products showing up in stores, and they're out there and they're hearing about this, or new marketing techniques. So yeah, most researchers would welcome a call like that, or an email saying, did you guys know about this? Yeah. You had.
Yes, you know, you raised the issue about social justice and expanding or returning to nursing's roots, but where do you publish your research? Do you find welcome in nursing journals? I don't. I find more welcome in other journals.
You know, that's really an interesting question. We publish a lot of our work in American Journal of Public Health and other public health-oriented journals. We have published some in nursing journals. I think nursing journals, you know, they need to be pushed a little too, probably, to, you know, to broaden their perspectives on what nursing is. You know, it's tricky, because nursing journals are also systematically disadvantaged by the fact that for years they weren't listed, they weren't indexed, and there were power reasons behind that. I can't quote it to you, but somebody has actually written a piece about this. So, you know, you look at them and their impact factors are not as high as some of the really established public health journals, for example. I just think it's a matter of getting it out there into the world and getting your work in the hands of as many people as you can. And different pieces are better targeted at different audiences. But it is interesting that way. That public health has a bigger net. And we've got to get nursing's net back out there. I mean, nursing is that big, but we've allowed it to kind of get shrunken up. So we have to push on that. Yeah. Was there another question in the back? Yeah.
Funded study, because the pressure to teach is enormous. University of Alaska is a workforce production machine, like many small institutions and nursing schools. And there just isn't room to buy out time to do that kind of research. Additionally, there's no, it doesn't give me an advantage in promotion to tenure. The pilot study would be enough for that. Can you comment on the maybe?
Yeah, well, I think there is a political economy to being able to do research, and certainly more teaching intensive institutions. I mean, we teach also, but our teaching load is not what some institutions like the CU system have, much heavier teaching loads. So that is really a significant barrier. But one thing that you can look at doing is nurses always kind of think they have to do everything. And you can build into your budget a postdoc that has some sophistication, or a project director, so that your role is more supervising the overall project, and have your project director or your postdoc taking the lead on getting things organized and writing papers, for example. And that's a model that I think you can use no matter where you are, but it does require time to supervise the overall thing. But, you know, that's one model that I've used, and some of my postdocs, my former postdocs, have gone on to become faculty members at the university themselves and write their own grants. So.
Maybe immediately seeing how what your ideas are
you have a specific call that you responded to?
No.
Can you talk a little bit about what you looked for in that RFA?
Well, we didn't respond to a specific call. This was just sent in as a cold RO1 proposal. Well, cold with our hot pilot data. But in general, I think most of my research projects have not been submitted in response to a specific RFA. What you do need to do is think about looking for what section might be the best to review and putting that in your cover letter. Most of my work has been through the community influences on health behavior section, and they do a lot of public health related and policy related stuff. But there are different sections, and depending on what you're doing, you can request, they don't have to honor it, but you can suggest that you think it might be appropriate for this study section. And that requires going on there and looking at all the study sections, which is fairly tedious. But once you kind of get one or two. And the other thing is to talk to a program officer. I think a lot of beginning researchers they're a little nervous about actually talking to a program officer at one of the institutes. Well, that is the number one thing you should do first. Because their job is to try to help you get money. They're not like some sort of gauntlet. They want to help you position your work in such a way that it will be received well. So they can give you some guidance on study sections you might think about putting in your cover letter as well. And they may also say, you know, I don't think this will fly here at the National Institute of Nursing Research, but you might try Heart, Lung, and Blood or wherever. So that would be, I think, my best advice. But don't start off with a giant, you know, grant if it's your first RO1. Have some pilot data and keep your budget fairly modest, although you do have to allow for the cuts that they almost always do to your budgets. But think about really what you need for this work. And if it's your very first RO1, you have an advantage now at NIH because new investigators actually are reviewed separately, so you're not having to compete against established people who've had dozens of RO1s or something. And so that's a very good thing for new people as well.